Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting our regular chat series with Kelly Gottlieb, Professor Emeritus at the University of Toronto. Kelly is one of the most significant contributors to computing education, the profession, and industry worldwide. Kelly, thank you for coming in today to share your insights with the audience.
Well, thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
Can you provide a brief history of how you initially got into computing?
Yes, I can. During the war, I worked as a civilian on the Proximity Fuse project, which is a very highly secret project. And in that, we put a little radio tubes in the nose cone of cells and made them into oscillators and thereby track their motion. So that required miniature electronics. Also, we'd fire these cells from anti-aircraft guns, sometimes at angles that for which there were no range tables, and we did a lot of calculation of range tables for firing. So during the war, I was both doing calculations, usually on desk computers, and electronics. And after the war, then, when the interest came up in electronic digital computers, it was a natural for me. We'd been following, there was a small group at Toronto that had already started to follow Howard Aiken at Harvard, his relay computers, and were going into electronics. And I was invited to join that group and did so.
And you eventually joined the ACM in 1949. Can you tell us more about the ACM and how you got initially involved?
Well, yes. As I say, I got into this into computing about 1948, and ACM, as you say, started in 1949. And I'm not sure how I. Well, actually, our group started to make visits to sites at Moore School in Philadelphia and Howard Aiken. So we knew about the Americans, and when they formed this group interested in computing, I decided to join it in 1949, as you say, which is about 2 years after its founding. And I got to meet the founders, the early principals, and contributed some art. There was Ed Berkeley, for example, who was one of the key persons, and I wrote some articles on the future of computing for his magazine, and Computers and Automation, I think he called it. And that's really what got me interested with him.
So, you know, you talked about doing some writing then. So how did you get into the ACM publications?
Well, I was a professor doing research, and I did some articles for Ed Berkeley's magazine, which was not a really research, it was a kind of journalistic thing. But I wrote some articles. I think I got into computers, starting on computers, and wrote articles, research articles, and that. And when the communication of ACM, which was the first, the first journal they started was Journal of ACM. But then later on, they formed the Communication of ACM. I was invited to become an editor of the business section, because I'd written articles on computers and insurance companies, and computers and sorting, and then when the editor, the founding editor of that, which is Alan Pernis, became president of ACM, he decided not to be editor-in-chief, so they invited me to become editor-in-chief of ComACM, which I did for about 3 years, and then the editor-in-chief of Journal of ACM, which was their first journal, had quit, and they invited me to move over to that, which I did. So I was on the, you know, involved with the publication for a period of about 8 or 9 years, quite heavily involved that way.
So that was sort of the history then of how you became editor-in-chief of these two flagship journals of the ACM.
Yes, that's right.
So can you tell us more about the book you wrote with Hume?
Well, that was a kind of fun thing. When we were doing our computing at the university. We started to give some courses. They were non-credit courses, but they were particularly attended by insurance people, actuaries, and so on, who were very interested in acquiring computers. So, as I say, I did sorting of computers, the use of computer and data processing in the computing industry, and we wrote this book we called High Speed Data Processing with Hume. My wife, who was a writer already at that time, helped us quite a lot in learning how to write terse English. And one of the things that has always been a source of great satisfaction to me, it turns out that the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary looked at that book, which was written in 1958, for how words in the English language like loop were being used in a new sense. And they picked out 11 words in that book, which were already in the language, but which had new meanings ascribed to them, and said this was the first use of these words in the language. I'm not sure that it was, but because we were using words that other people had already used. But anyway, they quote this as the first use of these words in the English language. So if you now look at the Oxford English Dictionary, the sort of the major edition, it cites us, Hume and myself, for 11 times. And a good friend of mine, Professor Marilles, friend department, says that makes us immortal, which is kind of nice because it's a nice, instead of a gravestone, you have a citation of first in the OED.
Well, that's a fairly significant contribution because you look at this fact that, this part of, the terminology that we grew up with, and really it's attributed to your group and this book with Hume. It's an amazing kind of accomplishment.
Well, we didn't do it consciously, but we had careful use of language. As I say, part of it was thanks to my wife. She taught us how to remove excessive verbiage from the word, so it was careful use of the language, and I guess that's what attracted the editors.
Well, something I find fascinating is that really you have collaborated with or worked with or you've met some of the leading pioneers like yourself in this whole industry. And in fact, in essence, you and others created this industry that we all work in today. One of the fascinating parts is that you met Turing in 1952. Can you tell us more about that time?
We at the University of Toronto, we started to do research in building computers. At that time, most research in computers was done at university. Eventually, of course, it gravitated to industry. But we were designing our own miniature computers. We produced something called UTEC. In Canada, Chuck River needed some computing facilities, and they persuaded us and the University of Toronto to use the money they allotted us to buy a copy of the Franti computer that was being built at Manchester by Williams, using, instead of mercury delay line storage, using cathode ray tube as storage for the high-speed memory. And that we made that purchase in 1952, and then I went, before the machine was delivered, which was September 52, I went over to England for about 6 weeks to learn about programming it. And Turing at that time was working in Manchester, so I met him, and I had two or three talks with him, not lengthy, but I certainly met him. And in fact, we eventually hired one of his students to come back with us to Toronto, somebody, Peter Bandler was his name.
I mean, do you have any sort of opinions on things like the Turing test and other kind of developments that came from Turing?
Yes, well, at that time we didn't know. The Turing test, I don't remember then, but of course he was famous because he had worked at Bletchley Park for the Enigma machine, so we knew about that. And at that time he was working, I remember when we talked to him and others about it, he said, oh, he was trying to do a four-leaf clover. Well, what he was actually doing was solving a a nonlinear differential equation, which has very significant differences than linear differential equation, and turns out to be really the origin of chaos theory. So it's kind of interesting that although computer people, you know, think of Turing and the Turing test and the giant which he was in the computer field, chemists regard him as the originator of chaos theory, and they regard him very highly for a completely different discipline.
You know, thinking about Turing, I think also about artificial intelligence, but you also did some work in AI, and didn't you do a lecture series early on for AI?
Well, I was always interested in, mind you, I guess we did know about Turing and machine thing, but I was always interested in trying to make machines do things that would look as if they were thinking. And there were a couple of things that things I had with graduate students. One of them was to make a computer play chess. Now the storage and the Manchester machine, the storage there wasn't enough to play a whole game, so we played end games, king pawn end game, which can be quite difficult because there's something called the opposition. And I had, as a student, I had someone, Frank Anderson, who was actually the chess champion of Canada at the time, program the computer to play end games in chess. And another thing I got interested in was in pattern recognition, and I had another student who was interested in music, see if we could get a computer to distinguish between the music written by Bach, Mozart, and Handel. So we would give it little pieces of music and see if you could tell which was the composer. So these were really problems. That was really a problem in pattern recognition, and during the early days of AI, that was a central, essential approach to AI. Nowadays, it's much more sophisticated, much more mathematical, but that's the kind of thing we did in early days.
One of the other things that you did too with the ACM was you actually got them to host the National Computing Conference here in Canada. I believe in September 1952. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, we were getting the Franti machine in September, which actually came in April 52. But it took a long time to get it going. But there was a tremendous interest in that Franti machine. So ACM, which was holding conferences, decided to hold, I think it was their fourth, actually, what they called the National Conference, and I think the only one they ever held outside of U.S., But they are all so anxious to see this Franti machine that they accepted our invitation to hold the conference there, and it was a very successful one. We had, almost everybody who was famous in computing come up to see that machine. One of the nice things, it was in the year 2002, when it was just 50 years after that, we invited ACM to hold its awards banquet, and I was chairman at that time. I was a position I still hold, chairman of the awards committee. They accepted that, and now the ACM at first it was heavily university, but now it of its 90,000 members, about 2/3 of them are practitioners. So all the meetings they held now, none of them are held at universities. I think we're in 1952, we had about the last major meeting of ACM at a university, 50 years after the 1952 meeting. So that was a source of satisfaction to me.
Yeah, again, it's sort of amazing history. You know, in your travels, some interesting things have happened. Like, you had an interesting offer from the dean at Cornell. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, I think about that time I was in the period of my editorship of the flagship journal, so I was fairly well known. And one day, while I was outside, walking outside the university, somebody introduced himself to me as the dean of graduate school of Cornell University, and he said they were starting up a new department, and he would like me to become the chair of the department. Well, it was interesting because he didn't make an appointment to him. I guess he felt it wouldn't be fair to meet me in an official capacity when he was trying to get me to move from Toronto to Cornell. Well, things were complicated in our personal life. My wife and I thought about it and decided that, well, I wrote him and said, look, right now things are going well in Toronto, and I think any limitation to what I can accomplish will be due to me, not to those that are put on me by the university. So I couldn't accept his offer and didn't. They then made the offer to Juris Yet Marinus, who is a very well-known one Turing Award and now a good friend of mine. So I never told Juris about it, but he found out about it by reading the literature at Cornell, I guess, and we've become and have been ever since quite good friends.
You know, something that you were involved with was in creating the glossary of computing. Can you share more about this?
Well, as I say, that I've forgotten. There was a NIFA committee for terminology and others. I wasn't involved in that for long, but I was on a glossary computing, so I don't really remember the details, but I think I was a participant in creating one of the early glossary of computing terms, and that because we'd already written his book which had been picked up at the OED. So you know, sort of careful language is an important part of writing, and I guess that's why I was invited to join that team.
Can you tell us more about this traveling lecture program that you did for the ACM?
Well, ACM, as I say, was in its early days, it was heavily populated by academics, and they set up a lecture program which would go around, which they made available to universities and volunteers who would give lectures would travel around. So I volunteered. At that time, one of my research interests was graph theory, four-color problem and four-color theorem and graph isomorphism and timetables. So these were, I had graduate students who were writing theses and things, so I set these up as lecture topics and went, and I must have gone around to about a dozen universities all over the place, including the Air Force Academy, Colorado Springs, and Texas, and Williams College, and, well, I guess I visited about a dozen universities through the state giving lectures. I think I had about three possible topics, timetable, graph theory, and something else, mostly combinatorial mathematics. And it was an interesting thing because it got me around the United States quite a lot. One thing that was very nice, I remember going to Williams College. They it was a little bit out of the way, and they chartered a sort of an air taxi to come. So when I left the airport, the flight number had mine was. It had my name as the flight number, so that's the only time I've ever been a flight assignment.
That's a really interesting story. And you also talked about just meeting some really remarkable people over your long history. And from your ACM work, this has afforded opportunity to even have guest lecturers come in. Can you share some stories about this?
Well, we've I was a lecturer, and we've had guest lectures coming in. And the other thing is, for about 20 years now, I've been chair and co-chair of the ACM Award Committee. So you get to meet the award winners, and they're usually very bright and very huge range of interest. And you get to meet the sort of vice presidents of Google, and so. You get to meet a wonderful range of interesting peoples, and it's one of the things that keeps me doing this is because you meet so many good people. I'm I was trying to recall particularly good stories, and you know, I know that many of the people. My job in the award, co-chair of the award committee, is to populate the about 20 award committees the ACM has. So I would often listen, go to conference, or listen to people who we've been invited, and they were very good candidates for the award committee, and I've had a pretty good success rate in getting people to say yes. About 3 out of 4 people I invite do agree to serve on the award committee. I know you alerted me that you were going to ask me this. I find it hard to think of particularly sort of funny incidents. There were some, but I'm going to pass on that for now.
Well, Kelly, there's this one story that we can cut out if you wish afterwards. I thought it was fascinating. You were talking about you had Vin Cerf come in, and you had your grad students, and they were talking about various projects, and how he was able to, every one of them, give him some meaningful advice to take him to the next stage.
Oh, he was amazing. I met Vin Cerf for the first time because when ACM brought its fellows committee into being, Vince had done all the work with council putting together the program, and I was chairman, and they agreed, they decided to have the fellows under the awards, and I was already chair of the award committee, so I met Vince then, and since then I've met him on several occasions, met him in Germany when I was getting an award myself from IFIP, and we invited him, and of course he's won the Turing Award, and I invited him to give a guest lecture, or one of the distinguished lectures at the university. And he was amazing. I mean, I was in, before the lecture, when we have a lecture, we try and have them meet with graduate students. The usual thing is to have maybe an hour session with the graduate students before or after the talk. And so we were sitting there in a room with about 15, 20 graduate students, and Vin went around the room asking each one to describe what project they were working on, and without fail he was able to make, you know, pick up what the main thing of their project was and make some suggestions as to where they would get interesting ideas. I mean, he was really amazing, and Vint and I are very much part of a mutual admiration society.
That's kind of a remarkable story. As you indicate, he's a Turing Award winner, but for him to be able to give sort of some meaningful advice from a variety of topic areas, just really off the top of his head.
Yeah, and you know, he was president of ICANN too, the International Committee for Signed Names and Nomenclature. So he's had a really, and incidentally, he and his wife are both deaf, so he's very active in promoting devices and to help hearing. So he's an interesting fellow in many directions.
So you've talked about this earlier already, and that is about your work on the various awards committees, and this work continues to this day. What additional insights can you share about this work with the various awards committees?
It's been remarkably successful, but when I started, the awards had a very low profile, and I was invited to become its chair. I think I've been on for about 20 years now. I now have a co-chair, who actually was a colleague at the University of Toronto, Jim Horning. We work together very well, as I say, the main job is to populate the award committee, but there are lots of other things, essentially, to set policy for the awards. And the awards has attracted a lot of, sort of grown, and attracted a lot of things. For one thing, now, perhaps you know, the Turing Award is worth $250,000. Google and Intel each contribute $125,000 for it. And there's a new award, which was given for the first time last year, the ACM Infosys Foundation Award, which carries $150,000. So it's got more and more profile. For the first time, for example, the Turing Award and the Infosys Award, not the first time, but now the winners are attract attention, and they're written up in the New York Times and places like this. They get Turing Award is always been spoken of as the equivalent of the Nobel Prizes for computing. And so they get a lot of attention, they get a lot of money attracted to support them, and they get a lot of the awards banquet, which is lately been alternating between San Francisco and San Diego, is a sellout each time, because, you know, there's so much computing activity and software activity in the West Coast that San Francisco and San Diego are kind of favored sites. I've always had a couple of interests in the... Well, the first thing is to make sure that the committees operate essentially on the basis of merit rather than an all-boys network. And you do that by you know, appointing people who themselves are achievers and look for and value high achievement. So I think something that has helped a lot is the recognition that the ACM award process is one that is very fair. And I've among other things, I've always wanted, for a long time I kept saying that I hoped I could stay in the award committee until a woman won the Turing Award, which happened last year. Fran Allen did it. And another thing I've been very interested in the award is making sure that there are some mechanics for recognizing young people who are achieving. And ACM does it through several things, through the programming contests, which are supported by Intel and IBM, and also through its contribution to the International Science and Engineering Fair. And I've actually, before I was chairman, or in fact, I think even while I was chairman of the award committee, I twice have been a judge at the Science and Engineering Fair, which is an amazing thing because at the International Fair, which happens each year, and next year it'll be in Las Vegas, I think, and you get about 1,200 students from 40 countries, and these kids are so bright and so enthusiastic and so knowledgeable that it's just an exhilarating experience to be there and listen to them tell what they've been doing. Many of these kids who are not in the university yet are doing research that actually merit and are published as original research. So it's really a, you know, a treat and an uplift to spend a couple of days with them while they tell you what they're doing.
You talked about this International Science and Engineering Fair and just the amazing sort of students and projects that you've seen at this fair. It sounds like some of the work is at a doctoral level.
Well, almost. I mean, these are high school students. You know, they're all high school students. And but incidentally, we've had some good winners from Canada in that. I think recently in Alberta we've had some kids win there, or maybe that's the programming contest. Yeah, but Canadians, I don't think have enough of a presence, but they're not without a mark there anyway.
With regards to the awards themselves, I know that you were able to establish some of the key policies in the early days of the awards, right, to bring that shape and formality to the awards?
Well, one of the things I did, which has worked well, is this. When I invite someone to an award committee, usually they serve for multiple years, 3 or 5 terms. And one policy I did was you gravitate up. When you're appointed to the committee, you gravitate up, and you become chair of the committee usually your second last year. Now, the nice thing about this is there's never any kind of Vorey or infighting or anybody. Anybody who's on the committee is deemed to be worthy of chairing the committee. So that's never a problem. There's never any concern in the committee. That was one policy. Another one I did was that the incoming and outgoing chairs are invited to the awards banquet and the award committee meeting. So when you're about to become chair, if you come to San Francisco or New York or wherever the meeting is, you get to meet the other committee chairs, and you get an idea of the culture of the committees. Many of them have their own slightly different culture, but ACM pays the travel expenses for incoming and outgoing chairs, and that provides sort of continuity. So these are things that kind of I introduced that helped the committee work well.
You also did work on the fellows area with the ACM.
As I mentioned, Vin Cerf actually put together the fellows program on behalf of council, and the fellows is one of most of the committees do their work by email and conference call, but there are three or four of them, of which the fellows one, which actually meets, because there's a huge amount of documentation, and they meet in New York every year around October to select the fellows, and that's a meeting I attend actually quite regularly, and once again to provide continuity and help and process. And although as a chair of the committee, I'm actually a committee member allowed to vote for the selection of the winners. I never do. We read the documentation. I make a choice, but I never tell them what. I never vote for the selection of the award winner, but we do provide continuity. What's the policy in award retention? What's the mechanics of informing the winner and informing the press and so on? So there's quite a lot of process involved in selecting the winners and trying to see that you get a press notice and right people are informed of what's happened.
As we come to a close with this interview, what else would you like to share about the ACM?
Well, it's a very dynamic organization. I think their budget is over $50 million, and they've done a number of smart things. As I say, when it started, it was heavily populated by academics. Now, I think about two-thirds of the membership are practitioners. Their budget, which they've got a low membership fee, which is $100, which really isn't much, although they actually, they now got, right now, for example, just to show how dynamic they're making very special efforts to recruit members in India and China and connect there, and the kind of thing they do is reduce memberships for two or three years for people in developing countries, but they know it's hard to get funds there. And much of their budget, one of the smart things they did, they have a lot of publications. I don't know how many yet, close to dozens and dozens of them. And they have the digital library, which puts all the publications online, and they sell that to universities. As a member, you have to pay extra, but if you're at an academic university, can subscribe to the digital library, and then any academic in the university can get it. So that digital library is subscribed to of hundreds of universities all over the world. It's been a big source of income to them, and now everything they publish is, most of them have a paper copy, hard copy, but all of them are online, and it's both of, it means libraries don't have to spend a lot of money to get the publication, especially in developing countries. They don't have to give it a lot of book space. and it's been a remarkable success. So they're very, very, you know, outgoing, and incidentally, they're making special efforts now to provide technical backgrounds for their practitioners who form such a large part of their membership, and they do that very well by conferences and digital library and things like that. So I'm quite admiring of the organization. I think they have a lot of lesson for others.
Something that I always found just sort of fascinating about yourself, Kelly, is just the amazing amount of awards that you've won. You've also achieved some of the most significant awards with the ACM. Can you share some of that with us?
Well, actually, being on the award committee, I feel it would be very improper to receive an award for a committee in which I'm a member. So the only ACM award that I have is one offered by the presidents. I've had other awards like you know, honorary degrees and fellows of four societies from three countries, and British Computer Society, Canada, so on, and I feel I've had all my share of awards, so I don't have to do any work to collect any others, and what I'm particularly proud of course, is the Order of Canada, which gained it, which incidentally, people at KIPPS were very, I think were really key in that for me. So I've always been grateful to KIPPS and people in KIPPS, and Marilyn Harris and others, who I'm pretty sure were the promoters of that.
But with the ACM, though, you've won some presidential distinctions, which are outside the scope of the sort of the normal awards process, and there's only been a few designated honorees of those kinds of awards, like the Presidential Award from ACM.
Yeah, well, that's the only award committee I'm not a member of, so I was able to accept that one.
But
and otherwise, if you go for an award of which you yourself voted, I always like to think of it as the Groucho Marx Award, you know. I don't want to be a member of a club that would have me as a member.
Well, again, it's just an amazing history with the ACM, and we're going to delve into other contributions and other paths that you've taken this simply remarkable career in this series of podcasts. So I thank you, Kelly, for coming in today and sharing your thoughts with our audience.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'm glad to have made contact with you not very long ago, it's enabled me to touch base again with KIPPS. As you know, I was there in the early years, and then for a long time, and also as part of life. But for a long time, I didn't have very much contact with KIPPS, and I'm glad to be able to reestablish connection through you and with others.
Well, again, it's a pleasure, and in fact, you're a KIPPS fellow, right? So, in fact, we met through really in a way by being KIPPS fellow. So.
And we met for the first time recently in Ottawa.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though we've done a number of interviews.
Right.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Vince.